Hello and welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns, and my guest today is a mountaineer, a writer, a broadcaster, and a television presenter. I think you would have to say he's the face of Scottish mountaineering, really. And I brought him along today to talk about his latest book, Come By the Hills. I'm talking, of course, of Cameron McNeish. Hello, Cameron.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. I'm fine. How are you?
That was a lovely introduction, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
I would just say that most of you, those things you said, I am probably now previous. Not so much of a mountaineer these days, and not a television presenter these days. But I have done all these things.
But you would have to plead guilty, wouldn't you?
Yes, guilty, my lord.
And what? Tell me about this new book. What inspired you to write this book?
I think I reached a certain age, John, when I realised that I couldn't do the things that I could have done 10 years previously.
Uh-huh.
And it really upset me. I was going out on the hills, and because of various degenerative issues, and that just means old age, I couldn't get around as easily as I could before, and it was hurting. And it kind of got to the stage where I had certain issues, which led me to think that, you know, this hill is probably my last hill. And then I'd crawl up another one, and then I think this hill. And every time I decided that that would be my last hill, what followed was a period of, not quite depression, but almost depression. It was like bereavement.
It is bereavement.
You know, and I thought, my God, you know, I've decided that's my last hill. And it's the hills that have made me the person that I am. I've earned a living from climbing hills for 45 years. People know me as a mountaineer, as a hill walker. People were ringing me up and saying, "Do you fancy a day out in the hill?" And I was finding excuses not to go because I was sore and I was slow. I wasn't mixing with all my usual friends because I felt I was being a bit of a fraud. I was still writing about this, but I wasn't actually doing it to the same extent.
Yes.
And it really got on top of me until, you know, I really had to take a firm grip of myself and say, look, if you can't go to the hills like you used to, you're going to have to adapt because you're missing these places. You're missing the wild places. Mm-hmm. Mountains aren't the only wild places we have.
No, that's right. I mean, I think it's your identity, isn't it, really?
Completely.
I went through a very similar phase where I realised my fitness wasn't what it was. And I made a mistake at the time. And I just said, well, that's it. I'll turn my back on the hills completely. I thought I could. I found that a lot more difficult to do than I actually thought it would be. But you adapted to the issues that are sort of
I did adapt. First of all, I bought a bike and I did some cycling. And that helped a lot. That was getting me out, and that was keeping me fit. So that was, that's a good start. I could do that without hurting. I'd climb a hill and come down and feel as though, I'd feel my age.
Yeah.
I'd go out my bike, I'd put a Lycra on, go out my bike and feel like a 21-year-old. It was wonderful.
What pants are those on?
But it was great. Another thing I realised that, and again, it was kind of rereading Nan Shepherd's book about the Cairngorms, The Living Mountain, where she talked about, mountain summits shouldn't really be the priority. And when I thought about it, all my, I've got such a host of great memories of the hills. And when I thought about it, the memories of actually touching a cairn were pretty minimal.
Ah.
What I remembered was, climbing up through the forest or reaching the ridge that went to the summit or seeing a fabulous sunrise, or seeing a golden eagle. These were the things that were uppermost in my memories.
Yes, yes.
It wasn't actually touching the cairn. So I kind of came to the conclusion that, summits aren't, I've climbed the Munros three times. I've climbed the Corbetts. I'm not too worried about touching cairns
anymore.
You've
got the badge now, haven't you?
And of course, living in the shadow of the Cairngorms are ideal for wandering without actually going to summits. And you know, and it helped a lot. So I can still go and I can still clamber. You know, my wife and I were over in Aberdeenshire at the weekend. We went up Benaghee, mm-hmm. and it was great. It was just good to get that bit of height and be able to wander about there. And I think wander is probably the word that describes what I do now.
Aye.
And learning about other aspects of the hill, like the culture of our mountains, the history and the folklore.
Yes.
And these are the things that I wanted to put in this book.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
The summits are still there. I'm still climbing to the hills and going down. But I wanted to kind of show people there's a lot more to our mountains than just Munro bagging. And I'm not knocking far be it from, I would never knock Munro bagging. It's been a great, huge part of my life for a long, long time. But I think when you get to a certain point, you realise that there's a lot more. I remember Hamish Brown telling me this years ago. And I didn't quite believe him. But I don't know exactly what he was talking about.
Well, I think one of the things that you said in your book, which sort of again sort of rang a chord with me, is you said that once you sort of decided that the summits weren't your main goal, you discovered a whole new sort of Scotland, and I certainly did. When I got back into it through doing various low-level walks and I sort of thought, wait a minute, there is something in this. You don't have to be running about the tops all the time. And then it drew me back into it. And I discovered a whole new Highlands beneath the 2,000-foot contour.
Yes.
And I don't know if that happened to you.
Yes. Well, it happened to me a long, long time ago when I first... really, when I kind of moved to Aviemore, and I got quite friendly with a lot of the lads who worked at Glenmore Lodge.
Mm-hmm.
And getting out with them, they were kind of pointing out things to me that I'd never really paid any attention to, like plants and flowers. And bloody flowers, you know. I come from Govan. I'm not interested in flowers, you know. But as I get older, I've become more interested in the botany of the hills.
Yes.
And the geology of the hills and the bird life. All these other things, and I think where we are just now in the history of environmental things in Scotland,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
these things are becoming much, much more important.
Absolutely.
And to have a wee bit of knowledge about them kind of broadens your whole appreciation of the hills. You know, I was brought up, and mostly when I started climbing hills, it was in the West Coast. And I loved the big empty spaces.
Yes.
I loved these big barren hills. That's what I was used to. And it was a long time before I realised, in fact, that what I was looking at was a degraded landscape.
Yes.
I still love these big, but you know, I find, and I know now my head says to me, there should be trees growing there, but my heart still says to me, I kind of still like it. I love the emptiness of it. But I know now that it was never always empty. That people did live there before. And, you know, I used to use the word wilderness a lot. I even wrote a book at one time talking about wilderness. That's I now know there's no wilderness in Scotland.
No.
There's all these things, I think. And I think it's the things that you learn to appreciate really through age. As you get older, you begin to appreciate a lot of these things. And I think I'm at the stage now where I can put these things together into a book. And I hope that's what I've done. I've also, you know, talked a wee bit about... Some of the great adventurers that I've met over the years. I thought I've lived an adventurous life, but my goodness, some of these people...
Like
the Ridgeway is up in Sutherland, you know. Like, what an adventurous life they've lived. And then I've told the story of a pal of mine from Gairloch. We were in a bothy one night and we were chatting about mountain biking, and I said to him, you know... I read somewhere recently that some twat has taken a mountain bike round all the mountains, and he said, it was me. His name is Paul Tattersall, and he was the first guy to take a mountain bike round all the Munros.
Really?
And I mean, I think he said himself he carried them out mostly.
Most of the time, yeah.
But what an adventure that was. I mean,
absolutely.
And that was back in the 80s or something.
And I think in the book you talked about Tom Weir quite a bit.
Well, Tom's my great mentor. Tom was a great friend, a great encouragement to me. I'll never forget the night I was living in Kincraig, not very far from here, and I'd been out in the hills, and I come home, and my wife said, you've had a visitor. And I said, oh, who's that? And she said, a little man with a big red bulbous nose, like the wee bobble on his cap. And I knew immediately who she was talking about.
Oh,
it was
right.
Tom Weir. And I said, oh, God, I'm sorry I missed him. She said, well, he's coming back this evening. So him and his wife, Rona, came back. And from that day, we became firm friends. And he really encouraged me. He came to visit me because I'd been writing stuff, and he just came to say hello. That was lovely, and he was a huge encouragement, particularly when I got into television. He gave me some really, really good advice working in television. I remember him saying to me, you've got to understand that your television crew won't be Hillgores like you, and they want to knock off at 5 o'clock at night. And it was a bit like that in the early days. Later on, when I worked with Richard Ells, who I worked with for 25 years, we actually chose television crews who were, you know, all hill walkers. So they were happy to stay out, they're happy to get wet, they're happy to get cold. They knew what it was like. So it made a big difference. But Tom was a real kind of motivating factor in my life. We had one period of 2 years where he didn't talk to me. we fell out because I'd written something about the Scottish Mountaineering Club should admit female members, and it was now 1990 or something, and the SMC didn't have female members, and this was really crazy. And Tom rang me up and he said, remember I invited you to join the SMC? And I said, yeah. He said, well, forget it. Put your phone down. Didn't talk to you for 2 years. But his wife, Rona, was a very enthusiastic member of the Scottish Ladies Climbing Club. So, they kept their activities very much separate. But, Tom was a great guy. Much missed. We'll never see the likes of Tommy again. And I don't think most people fully appreciate Tommy's achievements. He explored in the Himalayas.
Yes,
the
50s. He was a true mountaineer.
He was a real exploration mountaineer, a brilliant ornithologist. A really good ornithologist, and a great television character. He was Scottish Television Personality of the Year in 1975 or something like that.
Oh, right, that's
so a huge following.
Oh, right, okay.
And even after he stopped, for years after he stopped doing television, they ran his programmes during the night. So he got a whole new fan base of insomniacs and people who beat the pub and come home and watched all year. a wonderful character. And I miss him to this day, I really do.
Yeah. You know, going back a bit to what you were saying about you have a broader appreciation of the mountains. I perhaps have gone through the same thing to a degree, in that I think your relationship, well, relationships change, like any relationships, don't they? But I think there is a change in, there's almost a generational shift now, I think, in that when I started climbing a hill walk in the early 70s or whatever, we weren't really focused at all on the environment. You were just wanted to get to the top of that hill or up that climb as quick as you can and scarpa. And you never really thought about what was around there. Whereas when I've been talking to, I suppose, the next generation, younger folk on the hills, they seem to me to have a much deeper understanding of the environment. They're not as goal focused. Does that make sense to you?
It makes a lot of sense, and I'm very much encouraged by the attitude of a lot of younger people today, because they're much more aware of climate change than we are.
Yes.
You know, our age, it's not going to affect us that much. No. It's going to affect them, and it's going to affect their children.
Yeah.
And I'm really encouraged. I say, thank God somebody's taken an interest in this and, hopefully doing something like that. Greta Thunberg is a very good example.
Yes.
Thank goodness this is happening. So I think you're right. I mentioned earlier on too, the a lot of initiatives going on in Scotland just now on environmental themes. And I think there's quite a bit of publicity about it, and I think young people are picking up these things. But, it's interesting what you say about, having to get to the top. And I mentioned earlier about Nan Shepherd. And when she was writing The Living Mountain in the 40s and 50s, reaching summits wasn't actually that important.
Right.
I think when her book was written, not published, it was published much later on, but when it was written, there's only something like 15 people had climbed all the Munros.
Amazing.
It's amazing. And this is something that's really, it's a new phenomenon.
Yeah.
And I put it down to two things. Hamish Brown's book, Hamish's Mountain Walk, published in 1974, or he did the walk in 1974, where he climbed all Scotland's Munros in one expedition.
Right.
Wrote a wonderful, wonderful book about it. And I think that attracted a lot of people to Munro bagging. Another one was Muriel Gray, who did the television series The Munro Show. And people watched that and thought, God, this wee slip of a lassie from yes, Glasgow. I remember. Can, you know, can climb these hills, and I can as well. And I think the pair of them really encouraged this, what we now know, this phenomenon of Munro bagging. But it wasn't, you know, in Nan Shepherd's day,
it didn't exist.
In Bill Murray's day, it wasn't something. Even in Tom Weir's day, it wasn't really something that was that important. People explored, or they climbed, or they stravagued in the hills, but reaching summits wasn't that important.
That's interesting in a way, isn't it? Because I do feel that see, I've never been a Munroist. I go up a hill if I feel like it. If I don't, I don't. I think that's probably being called lazy, basically.
I
wonder if we've gone through a stage where I do feel that in some ways folk can be followers these days. That culture's around. If you put a line on a map and call it a way, folk will follow it.
Mm-hmm.
If you're the North Coast 500, you call it a pling, and they will set off in the camper vans. I'm sorry about this.
You're right.
And then if you write a list, people will follow that. Whereas personally, I feel the joy of the hills is to go where you want to go. And it sounds to me as though perhaps we're moving back towards. I didn't realise that earlier that philosophy was perhaps more prevalent than it has been over the last 20 years. Mm. Do you think truth in that?
Yes, I think we have. We've kind of. I think Munro bagging peaked a number of years ago.
Right.
But I think it's on the ascent again, if you pardon the pun. I think it's on the rise again.
Aye, aye.
And really, because people, we live in the Instagram age, people like to stand by a cane with a selfie and put it on.
Yes.
And I think that's what's driving the current Munro bagging, mountain bagging theme. Mm-hmm. And it kind of amazes me, it slightly depresses me, going onto social media and seeing people write things like, you know, bagged three at the weekend or bagged several then and there's nothing else about the mountain or the experience. It's just
off. I think
this is an age-old conversation, Pete. I mean, this is
it.
Since Munro bagging started, people have been having these debates.
I do feel that there's the sort of bucket list culture has diminished things to a degree.
Yes,
because it might be on your bucket list to do a bungee jump, or maybe to climb Ben Nevis, or then maybe to go in a canoe somewhere. Whereas that in my day, or was it still my day by my reckoning, but climbers were climbers. That's what they did, and they were a community, and you didn't try climbing then abseiling then something else and something else and something else. You specialised in that, and the difference is, I think that I suppose if you're going to specialise in something, you essentially have to learn the skills to do it, and that is a process through which I think you grow.
Yes.
But I think if you are someone who just wants to abseil, to say tick it off their list, all they'll do is be put at the top of the rope by someone who's instructing them. They'll slide down it, and they may never do that again.
Mm-hmm.
I think we lose something.
I think we do. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there was a time where if you're a climber, you climbed. If you're a hill walker, you padded the hills. And if you were a canoeist, and they were very separate.
Yes.
Nowadays, people do everything. You see people in the car, and they've got a mountain bike on the back.
That's right.
They've got a canoe on the top, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
When I started in the outdoors, I started walking when I was a teenager, and then I joined a mountaineering club and I became a climber, and looked down on walkers, you know, dirty hill walkers.
Yes.
You know, you would never use the word Munro baggy without prefixing it with the word dirty.
Okay, fair enough.
Or something stronger that starts with F, you know. Dirty Munro baggers, you know. And you wouldn't, I mean, if people saw you walking in the hills, you'd be a bit embarrassed. You know, if you had a rope around your shoulder and everything, and that was fine. But yeah, and that changed. And that, for me, that changed when I moved to the Cairngorms. I moved to Aviemore. And I was running a youth hostel in Aviemore. So I was going out to the hills at different times to most people, so I didn't have a regular climbing partner.
Right.
I was kind of wandering the hills, and it was fantastic. And that's, you know, I mentioned earlier on, the Cairngorms are great for wandering without going to summits particularly. This is a lot of space, and there's a lot of...
Because they don't have, you know, very spiky summits, do they?
Well, the biggest sort of area is over 4,000 feet in the country. Biggest area is over 3,000 feet. Yes. Biggest area is over 2,000 feet in the country. It's huge.
It is.
So that was good. So that changed, and I continued to climb for quite a long time, but eventually found I was walking more and backpacking more, something that sort of became in the vogue in the 70s, this American word, backpacking, and putting everything in a rucksack and going off for a few days. And that's what I did for a long number of years. And then went back to Monroe bagging and, you know, I kind of did them all. But nowadays, and it really suits me fine, I go off my wee camper van and I've got my bike in the back, I've got my hiking boots inside, I've got a pack raft, I'll maybe take it on a river or a loch, and I kind of do all these things.
Right.
Well, it suits me now to do that.
Yeah.
But you kind of get the best of all worlds. I've paid a binoculars, so I want to go and do a bit of bird watching.
So you become
the kind of complete outdoors person rather than a mountaineer or whatever. And I think, you know, during lockdown, it was really interesting for me where we could only kind of walk within 5 miles of home.
Yes.
And I was visiting little places, you know, just round about here, that I hadn't been to for years. And it was terrific. And I saw the value in those places. I saw the beauty in those places at that time. And that kind of widened things for me even further. So it was an interesting time.
Yes, yes. I think you're right. I think I'm coming to the stage where I was never a beach person. And yet these days I can find as much enjoyment from wandering along a beach and maybe doing a bit of photography and capturing some of the images. Yeah.
But I mean, there are beaches and beaches. You know, there's a beach at Saltcote, so there's the beach at Luskintyre. And they're a world apart. or your beaches in Ibiza, or, you know, and some of these other wonderful beaches we have in the northwest, is, you know, the Sandwood Bay, for example.
Exactly.
You know, they're worlds apart.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's some wonderful beaches.
I mean, you know, COVID has made us look at the way we relate to the outdoors. There's been lots in the press about you know, various areas that have been under quite a lot of pressure, and I think it sounds to me as though actually it's taken a lot of folk into the outdoors who wouldn't normally have done it.
Yeah.
Simply, perhaps they would maybe have gone to Spain and they can't do that. And perhaps, you know, simply because they've been caged up for so long, the need to get out has just exploded within them. And but somehow if we just talk about the Highlands, you know, we've somehow got to cope with the pressure of these folk in particular areas whilst protecting what we want to protect, but also allowing folk to do what they want in the outdoors. Because after all, you know, if you want to protect the outdoors, people have to be allowed into it. You know, you don't value the outdoors until you've got to know it.
That was John Muir's philosophy.
Right.
Let's encourage people to go to these areas. Let's make them national parks. Mm-hmm. Encourage people from the cities to come. And in that way, we'll prevent the loggers from chopping down all these great sequoias and all the rest of it. And it's quite a good way of thinking. And it kind of, it's been my theory for a long, long time. But I'm now beginning to think there's, you know, a lot of people who come to the countryside or the outdoors, whatever you want to call it, who don't really appreciate the fact that we have to look after these areas. Mm. It's a me thing. I'm coming here and I want to enjoy it and I want to have a campfire here and I don't care if I disturb other people. Now I think that's part and parcel of the sort of mass exodus that we've seen this year. And I think a lot of the people who have come to the outdoors this year, we won't see them again because of the rain, because of the midges, because there's maybe too many of them.
The midges were great.
So there will be a natural culling process. And I hope that lots of others who have come to the countryside for the first time, lots of people who went to the hills for the first time, will say, hey, that was good. And that has helped my mental stress.
I'm hoping that I think a lot of people will have taken their children out into the outdoors for the first time. And I really think it's very, very important to experience the outdoors as a child. Because if you do that, it kind of seeps into you as normal, as part of you.
Yeah.
And that will come back in later life. Because we've been in danger. We're very much in danger of having a generation that's lived on concrete and only sees the wild through screens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right, and I think that's why, you know, I've always been very, very keen on telling the stories of the hills, and it's the sort of thing that you would hear around the fireside from your grandparents and to tell you the stories of the hills. And it was always when I climbed hills, I was always very keen to find out who lived here before and what sort of lives did they lead and what were the legends and what were the things that inspired them. And again, with this book, this is something I'm trying to, you know, put across, telling the stories of people like Duncan Ban MacIntyre, one of the greatest poets of Gaeldom, who lived near Bridge of Orkney, wrote the wonderful poem in praise of Ben Doran, and people like him, and you know, the story of the Blackwater Reservoir and the men who lived there, the labourers and the itinerants who lived there, very close to death. So often, but to create these huge industrial complexes, if you like, in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
And the great story is to know there's a wonderful little graveyard near Blackwater Reservoir. And it's like, if you remember the old cowboy films, there was always a boot hill with these little plinths.
Yeah.
And there's all these little plinths on this little hummock, and they're made of concrete. You know, that's the stuff, that was the material they were working with on the dam.
God.
And your names like, I remember one, Darkie Robinson was one, and Joe and some, and then there's one, Mrs. So-and-so. And I thought, why was there a woman there? Was she a cook? What was her role in all of this? All these stories are there.
We
have wonderful places like that in Scotland, wonderful, I kind of call them, I've forgotten what I call them.
Well, it is what you're talking about. I think you refer to it as the spirit of the place.
Spirit of place, that's exactly it. Spirit of place.
And that resonated with me, because I don't know about you, but I like to be alone in the hills, and yet I never feel alone in the hills, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I'm always conscious that, you know, you walk through any Highland glen, and you'll often find, you know, the outline of where there was a house a few hundred years ago and a little community. I always feel that those people and their presence and their history is still all around me. I don't know, does that resonate with you?
Exactly. And I remember my wife and I were walking the Southern Upland Way quite a number of years ago, and we stopped at a place called Riskin Hope. Hope. And hope has nothing to do with, you know, things going to be good in the future.
Yeah.
Hope is a little valley with a meandering stream going through it in Border Lore. So this place was called Riskin Hope Hope, and it was a deserted farmhouse. It was a ruin, and we stopped there for lunch, and my wife kind of wandered on a bit, and I sort of sat there for a while, and I've never seen a ghost. I've never heard a ghost. I've never had a supernatural experience. But I was aware that this was a place where children had played and children had laughed and people had lived their lives and you know, couples had made love together and had ambition. And I don't know why it all came to me in that moment, but suddenly this was more than just a ruin. And it was.
Yeah.
I explained this sometime later to a guy called David Craig, who wrote a wonderful book called On the Crofter's Trail. And it was a book about the Highland Clearances. And the book was based on interviews with the descendants of the people who'd been cleared. So David went to Australia, New Zealand, to Canada, and he got all these stories of the people. And we were at a place called Borrerig on Skye, an abandoned village. And we were kind of talking about this. And we did it on television. And he said, if you think of it, you know, there was a track there, and the state had put in quite a new track. So for the first time, they could get the postman coming down, and you know, they'd have crops here, and they'd be fishing in the sea. Their life would have been full of hope. Their life would have been full of you know, what's going to happen? It's going to be great here and we're going to do this. And then suddenly, wham, the state came along and said,
that's it.
We want the land. Get out of here.
Yeah.
And how awful that must have been for people. So there's all, all these things. And we, as we sat at Borrowrigg that day, and David is such a lovely storyteller, you could almost feel the anguish of the people who were cleared from that beautiful place. You could feel the hopelessness, the helplessness of these folk who didn't know what the future was.
No.
They had no idea. And there's a story in Lochorn and Barrisdale, people who had been cleared, were on a boat, and when they got to the end of Lochorn, they didn't know if they were going to North America or Australia. Yeah. Horrendous.
So it really, so the book you've written really is I think embodies a lot of the history and a lot of the culture, and I think your own love of the hills really comes out of it very strongly.
Oh, good.
And I think it's a great piece of writing. So Come by the Hills comes out today, I think. So so that's great, and I really hope people enjoy it. Thanks very much for talking to me.
My pleasure.
It's really been good.
Thank you.
And here's Cameron reading a short section of his new book, Come by the Hills.
At the time of publication, Nance Shepherd's book, The Living Mountain, cast a new light on these big, burly Cairngorm mountains, encouraged me to look at mountains generally in a different way. I began to focus more on the micro, the lichens, plants and birds, as opposed to simply concentrating on the big picture and the macho determination to bag summits. In many ways, Nance Shepherd's writing about the Cairngorms made me open my eyes and refocus. As I've suggested earlier in the book, there are sections of Nance's book that just lose me. To a lad from Govan in Glasgow, Zen Buddhism was a leftover from the hippie days of the 60s. But having said that, I thought it was worth examining some aspects of our poetic treatise, aspects that perhaps offer food for thought for those of us who climb hills, ideas and notions that, for me, provided a pathway to other works of transcendent mountain literature by the likes of Barry Lopez, Ralph Waldo Emerson, H.G. Thoreau, Aldo Leopold, and Gary Schneider.